It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The teen birth rate is on the decline, and a new study says reality teen pregnancy shows like MTV's 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom might have helped that decline along.
The study looked at Nielsen ratings and birth records and concludes that controversial shows like 16 and Pregnant reduced the teen birth rate by as much as 6%.
In case you haven't seen the show before, here's just a little taste from an episode in the third season.
Joey isn't ready for a lot of things, and neither am I. We definitely aren't ready to live together with Joey's parents, but that's what we have to do because after I told my dad I was pregnant, I had to move out. It's important to me that my baby has both parents, so going to my mom's in New Jersey wasn't an option. My only choice is to live with Joey's parents, which makes me very uncomfortable, especially since I can tell Joey's mom really doesn't want me to be there.
And that was a clip from MTV's 16 and Pregnant. And we want to know what you think about this. Do you think reality pregnancy shows help educate teens about pregnancy, or do they glamorize it? What do you think is behind the decline in the teen birth rate? And did you have a baby when you were a teenager, or did you have a child of yours have a baby when he or she was a teen? You can call and share your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We'll welcome our guest now. Bill Albert is Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into these MTV shows, I think there's maybe a constant sense in this country that the teen pregnancy problem is always getting worse. It's always worse than when we were kids. But as we just mentioned, the numbers are on the decline, right?
Truly, one of the nation's great success stories over the past two decades has been the extraordinary declines in teen pregnancy and childbearing. They have been going down steadily for a bit over 20 years now. And we have seen, importantly, progress in all 50 states and among all racial ethnic groups. And not to throw too many numbers at you here, but the sort of decline we're looking at is the teen birth rate, which peaked in 1991, has now declined 52%. If there are other sort of pressing social problems that have improved as dramatically, I'm not sure what they are.
Well, there are a lot of reasons, I'm sure, for that decline. We'll probably touch on some of them through the conversation, but I want to hear what you think of a show like MTV's 16 and Pregnant. It follows, like the tin says, it follows a 16-year-old who's pregnant, and then Teen Mom was a spinoff. It shows what life is like for these teens with a kid. As someone who studies teen pregnancy, what was your first impression of a show like that?
Well, to be quite candid with you, we have been fans of this show since it has gone on the air. We have seen it, at least in our view of watching these shows, that they are much more sobering than salacious. And rather than glamorizing teen pregnancy, we felt that they helped in very important ways to underscore just how challenging it can be to have a child as a teenager and raise that child.
So what sort of things might, say, a 15- or 16-year-old see on one of these shows that would actually influence their behavior?
Well, I think there are any number of things, but I think the overall gestalt here is probably the most important. That what you see, by and large, are young women, and I say young women because the young men are generally not still in the picture, that are really struggling. They're struggling with their parents. They're struggling trying to complete their education. They're struggling with their plans for the future, any number of things. But overall, I think it just provides this message that this is a really difficult and challenging thing to accomplish for anybody, let alone, say, a 16-year-old who is trying to complete high school.
So you had a good feeling about the impact these shows might be having. Along comes this research we mentioned. Some researchers did a lot of studies and found, apparently, where there's more watching of these shows in households, there's less teen pregnancy. Were you surprised at the impact that this study found?
You know, we weren't surprised that the shows might affect teenagers' decisions about sex. We were bowled over by the magnitude of the effect, as you mentioned. The researchers here say that these shows are very closely connected to about one-third of the decline in the teen birth rate in the period that they studied. So while we weren't surprised that it would have an effect, the size of the effect was quite shocking.
Do you, having looked at the research, think it's pretty sound?
Well, let me describe it this way. Both of these researchers are very serious researchers, and this is a very serious attempt to try to tease out a very difficult topic. I mean, it is hard to measure media influence for any number of reasons, and I think they have done a remarkable job at trying to evaluate the impact of the shows, if any. And you know, I sort of jokingly call them Doctors No and No because their previous research on teen pregnancy has essentially showed how little an effect other things have had. So coming from them with a reputation of sort of saying things don't work, that carries some weight.
Well, interesting part of the research, I had mentioned just the comparing Nielsen's for these shows and the birth rates. They also looked at what was happening on places like Twitter after these shows aired and the kind of internet searches that people were doing after the shows aired. Can you speak to that a little?
Yeah, I think, you know, in particular, anyone who's watched television with a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old, you realize it's not a single-screen experience anymore. That they're chatting with their friends about what they're watching. They're looking at message boards that may be just talking about the show. They might even click to a link that they may have seen in the show or search for something that was talked about in the show. And I think that's exactly what's going on here and what the researchers noted. A huge explosion, for instance, in people seeking information about birth control. And lots of conversation about the shows themselves and the characters in the shows, but also about the topics they talk about, like talking to your parents about sex and relationships and contraception, things of that nature. I mean, there's a direct connection, not surprisingly, that when these shows are on the air and millions of young people watch them, that there's an explosion sort of in this social media and searches on the internet.
You mentioned the glamorization idea earlier, and what groups critical of these shows have said was whatever the message is, what we're doing is making celebrities out of young, pregnant, 16-year-old girls. Do you see that as a possible downside?
Well, I understand that concern, but I will tell you quite frankly that the people who tend to say that these shows glamorize teen pregnancy tend to be the same people who have never seen the shows. And I have a theory about this. I call it sort of the grocery store checkout theory, that for people who are going through the grocery store aisle and see the magazines, the Us magazine with these young women on the cover, I think it's understandable for them to conclude that, gee, why are we glamorizing this? But for anyone who watches the show, I really do challenge them to see anything in there that strikes you as particularly glamorous. I think there's a difference, in other words, between what the shows actually portray and how the media covers the shows.
Usually in the media, when we use the phrase media influence, something bad is going to follow those words. It's negative. Do we not pay enough attention to opportunities for positive media influence on something like teen pregnancy?
I think you're exactly right. You know, as a general matter, parents of teens have viewed MTV as the axis of evil, right? All that is wrong in teen culture and elsewhere can be laid squarely at the feet of MTV. And I think as a more general matter, we do tend to point to the entertainment media and think of all the negative influence it has on our culture. Why is it implausible to think that the entertainment media might be a force for good? And I think that's what we've seen in this research. You know, the analogy I think of is teenagers and peer influence. When we talk about peer influence among teens, as adults, we generally talk about negative peer pressure. But in fact, oftentimes, more often than not, peer influence can be quite positive. And I think that's what we're seeing here with some of these entertainment media programs.
We're talking with Bill Albert, Chief Program Officer for the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, talking about the influence of MTV programs like 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom, new research suggesting it is helping to decrease teen pregnancy around the country.
And we'd love to know what you think about this. Do you think reality pregnancy shows help educate teens about pregnancy, or do they glamorize it? Do your kids or grandkids watch these shows? And if so, does that worry you? Did you have a baby when you were a teenager? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Bill Elbert, Chief Program Officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy.
We're talking about a new study that suggests MTV's reality shows about teen moms, shows like Teen Mom and 16 and Pregnant, actually reduce teen pregnancy.
And we'd love to know what you think about all this. Do you think reality pregnancy shows do their job and educate teens about pregnancy, or do you think what they do instead is glamorize these teen moms? And what do you think it is behind the decline of the teen birth rate? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We'll go straight to our callers now. We've got Rebecca on the line in Eau Claire. Rebecca, hi.
Hello.
What do you think of these shows?
Hi, I was just coming out of high school when these shows started airing on MTV, and so I was an avid viewer. I actually had a lot of friends who were teen moms, and I think that the shows don't glamorize it per se, but I think they show an accurate perception or an accurate view of what these women and young ladies are actually going through. And I'm surprised that the research is finally being discussed. I wasn't very surprised by it, though, because they do show such an accurate picture of what's going on in the lives of the teen parents.
Rebecca, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. Bill, somebody not far out of, I guess, the target demographic there. What do you think of what she had to say?
Well, you know, of course, everyone who watches the show will take away different things from it. And I think, you know, even for some parenting teens, they might find offense at it. They might even look at these shows and say that it's continuing some stereotypes that people have about teen mothers. But I think, you know, at some fundamental level, that one of the most critical things that is happening here is that these shows are clearly generating conversation, peer-to-peer conversation, about pregnancy and related issues among teens. And that, in essence, is all to the good.
Thanks, Rebecca. We'll go now to Catherine in Green Bay. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thanks so much for the show. As with any other MTV program, you assume that, you know, their primary objective in targeting any kind of reality program or any kind of reality characters is that they're trying to make celebrities, they're trying to be salacious with whatever they're doing and make a really exciting program. And whether or not they set out to do it when they first conjured up the idea, I think they've really struck gold with the characters that they found in that, you know, these are working class families. They have the same kind of struggles of any other family. But, you know, whether it's been the celebrity or the pregnancies themselves, you know, a lot of these girls have really encountered a lot of problems and, you know, done anything but glamorize their situation. So, you know, if for whatever reason, MTV has really done a service, as the research proves, in showing that, you know, teen pregnancy is anything but, you know, shopping at Baby Gap and, you know, having a lovely relationship with your high school sweetheart. I mean, it's been really interesting. So for anyone who hasn't seen the show and thinks that, you know, this is really going to make teens want to run out and get pregnant, oh my gosh, it's absolutely anything but that. So bravo, MTV.
Catherine, thanks for the call. Bill, can you tell us what kind of things it sounds like they don't sugarcoat what life is like? What are some of the particular things in these shows that might be eye-opening for a teen?
Well, I mean, you see real struggles throughout these shows with parents, the decisions that the young people want to make, the sort of lifestyle they want to live, you know, sort of counting on mom to take care of the baby so they can go to the prom, things like that. You see real struggles with the father of the child who, as I mentioned earlier, is very rarely in the picture. And if so, they tend to be struggling. And, of course, all of the common sense things you might expect. You know, raising a child is challenging for even the most stout among us. And for 16 and 17-year-olds in these shows, you see just how profoundly challenging it can be in trying to raise a child and complete your high school education and consider doing things like going on to college and getting a job.
We're going out to Nick in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
was a little offended by the shows, but then I'm a child with a teen pregnancy, and so I was kind of offended by it. Like, my mom lives a block away. I haven't seen her in 2 years. I've never met my dad, so I think it's a little more personal for me. The only good thing about it was that I'll never leave my kids, ever leave my kids.
All right. So, Nick, thanks for sharing your story, and I'm sorry about that story. So, as I think you may have mentioned, Bill, some people might read this differently and even take offense at it.
Yeah, that's quite right. I mean, there have been critics of the show, understandably. Everyone, again, views and has different feelings about this. But, you know, MTV didn't set out with these shows to do anything other than to help share some of the stories of young, pregnant, and then parenting teenagers. And I do understand for some who watch this that it can be painful to watch, and they may not see themselves in the characters there, and that's quite understandable.
I have a comment. A listener called in and said, I was married and pregnant at age 16, dropped out of high school. I love my two kids, but I would never recommend it to anyone ever. This show, they write, is awesome because it shows how difficult it is and how ridiculous it is to have kids at that age. And Bill, you say when peers are starting to talk to each other about the show, that a lot of times sounds like the message they're relating to each other.
That's absolutely right, and that message the person wrote in is spot on, and it's what we hear and have heard for 20 years now. As a general matter, what you hear from young parenting teens is something along the lines, I love my child, I love my children more than life itself, of course, but if I had to do it all over again, I would probably change the circumstances. I probably would have waited longer. I probably should have waited until I was a bit more established.
So for parents out there listening of kids at the target age here, tweens and teens, how can they use shows like this to maybe start a conversation?
Well, you know, first, parents need to understand something that they really don't believe, which is their influence over their teenagers' decisions about sex is really, really important. Both 25 years of social science research and public opinion surveys of teens point out that it is parents, not peers, not popular culture, not even their partners, but it's parents that teens say most influence their decisions about sex. So parents need to understand first and foremost that when it comes to their kids' decisions about sex and relationships and love and contraception, that they can and should play a critical role. And of course, these shows, we think anyway, can be a real way to have some of these important discussions between parents and teenagers. After all, it sort of takes the burden off saying, what are you doing or what's going on in your life, and sort of being able to talk freely about the lives that you're seeing on the screen in front of you.
It's a weird question to ask, but do you in the teen pregnancy community think you can learn lessons from MTV that you can apply in teen pregnancy efforts around the country?
Well, I think it's important to say when we reflect back here now on the 20-plus years of declines in teen pregnancy, it really has been a kitchen sink approach that has helped drive the rates down. You know, there are many other factors besides MTV at play here that have contributed to the impressive progress the nation has made, including increased investments in proven sex education programs, substantial, really, action and leadership on these issues at the state and local level. You know, in recent years, the economic downturn has played a role, and of course, the availability and use of contraception has played a critical role here. So I think one of the things in answer to your question is that we need to press forward on a number of fronts if we're going to continue to succeed. And I think that these shows and MTV really can be ways for parents and kids to talk about these issues and, you know, might be able to be used in school settings, in sex education classes, et cetera.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Bill Albert. He's Chief Program Officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy.
Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a second chance bill for young criminal offenders. It's getting bipartisan support from former Wisconsin governors.
Reminder that you can always follow us on Facebook. We are Central Time on WPR. You can always tweet us also and follow us. We're Central Time WPR. And on the topic of technology, if you don't have a radio at home, a lot of people don't anymore, your phone or tablet can do the job for you. Get the WPR app. It's a great way to listen. I do it in the kitchen, actually, in the morning, listening to the Joy Cardine Show. Go to your App Store, your Apple Store, and get the WPR app and keep listening. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The bill would change how some juvenile offenders are tried in Wisconsin is gaining support in the state legislature. In a recent opinion piece, two former Wisconsin governors at the opposite ends of the political spectrum voiced their support for the bill as well.
The so-called Second Chance Bill would return nonviolent first-time 17-year-old offenders to the juvenile justice system as opposed to the adult court system. Supporters say it's the best way to rehabilitate those offenders while still holding them accountable.
Joining us now to talk about the proposed legislation is Jim Moser, Deputy Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start by looking at the law as it stands now.
Sure.
So if a 17-year-old commits a nonviolent offense, how is that prosecuted in Wisconsin today?
Sure. Right now, any 17-year-old committing any offense, and it could be anything from a ticket, local, municipal citation for retail theft or disorderly conduct up through, you know, really any offense, gets filed or referred anyway to the adult system, and that could be an adult ticket or, in some cases, referral to the adult criminal court. And then it's up to the adult criminal court, the prosecutor, to sort of figure out how to prosecute and what kind of disposition and sentence to impose. But it's all adult, and it's all an adult record.
So if that same teenager is routed instead into the juvenile system, what happens differently?
What would happen differently is, for the first time, what we're proposing is for the first time nonviolent 17-year-olds that be referred to, again, either a local, if it's a local municipal court, that it's done, treated as a juvenile, which has an impact on sort of what information is public and sort of what their record is, and oftentimes has things more appropriate for kids like community service and than necessarily fines that kids can't pay anyway. If referred to the formal court system, it would be referred to the juvenile court system, and an assessment is done and determination of whether to formally charge the youth, and if so, what kinds of services are needed to sort of get the youth back on track in the juvenile system.
Now, you think that we need to move in the direction of putting nonviolent offenders, teenagers, 17-year-olds, into the juvenile court. Why do you think we need to move in that direction?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is because we know that there are some implications and ramifications for 17-year-olds who end up with an adult record in terms of future employment, even things like access to federal student aid, things that for 17-year-olds who commit a, again, nonviolent offense, who don't have a record, ought to get a shot in, you know, getting the kind of services they need. So we also know that the services are much more readily available in the juvenile system, and there's pretty good research that shows that, you know, basically providing those kinds of services gets the youth back on track, but and ultimately has pretty significant reductions in their reoffending behavior. So
and
it's kind of good for them and good for the community.
In terms of the long-term effects on 17-year-olds who go into the adult system, what are the ramifications there?
Well, again, those records are now, given our current system, those are available online. Future employers can look at those. Landlords can look at those. And as much as we would like to think that they wouldn't hold those kinds of things against the youth, if an employer finds a 17-year-old applying for a job who has a record versus a 17-year-old who doesn't, you know, it's pretty likely they're going to take the youth who doesn't.
So you're saying this is the kind of thing that you do something at 17 and it can follow you your entire life and change the direction it might have taken.
Correct. And some of these kids will end up in the adult jail, which is certainly much riskier for youth than being held in a juvenile facility. And that record does track with them. There are provisions for getting that expunged at times. There are some courts that are more likely to do that than others. But in terms of services, things like drug and alcohol services, for instance, we have 17-year-olds in the adult system who can't legally get the services they need because they're not 18. They can't sign contracts. They can't vote. They can't do any of the kinds of things adults can do. They can't serve on a jury, but yet they could be convicted by a jury. So there's all kinds of contradictions in that. Our proposal really is meant to be, again, those first-time, nonviolent 17-year-olds who, you know, do things that are, certainly can affect the community, but are not serious offenses. And the bill still provides that if the prosecutor believes it should be filed in adult court, they can still propose that to the court, and the youth could still be waived to adult court.
Now, in this morning's paper, there were a couple of opinion pieces by former Wisconsin governors. One was by Jim Doyle, another by Tommy Thompson. And in the case of Jim Doyle, it's an interesting one because he, in his past political career, was one of the people who helped funnel 17-year-old nonviolent offenders into the adult system. Why has he changed his mind?
Well, both of them, and certainly Governor Thompson was involved, was the one that signed the law changed in 1995 that moved 17-year-olds into the adult system. Back in 96, and at that time, and Doyle, of course, was Attorney General. And both of them at the time, there were a couple things going on. One was there had been a rise in serious juvenile crime in the late 80s and early 90s that actually peaked in 94. There was a feeling that the current law at that time was too heavily weighted towards protecting juveniles. And there was a sense that the way our system was funded and resourced, the best way to sort of get it back on track was to get 17-year-olds into the adult system. Since that time, both in terms of, again, better research about which system is really more effective, and this bill, which really tries to differentiate between serious offenders and basically dumb 17-year-olds who make, who do something stupid. I think they really have just come to believe that, we've learned more about how the brain works. The research is stronger about what works, what's more effective. And this proposal still allows serious offenders to be treated in the adult system. So I think they would argue, and of course they do in what they wrote, that this is really a step that can benefit the youth and the communities.
What you just said, that's something Tommy Thompson echoes in his piece. He says, sometimes kids make poor choices, and Jim Doyle references recent brain research. I'm guessing he's talking about research on teenage brains, which points to brains that are more likely to be impulsive and be risk-taking. So in your mind, is that part of this piece here that we need to maybe understand the brain of the teenager and legislate accordingly?
Well, I think yes. I would caution I would sort of wrap around that there are 19, 20, 21-year-old, young adults who, we know that the brain isn't really that well developed in those areas until mid or, later, 23, 24, 25. So one could argue that's an issue all along, and it is. We ought to be able to find ways to assess kids and deal with them constructively, and we just think the juvenile system is better able to, more geared towards that and better able to do that. It's also much faster. I think everyone would agree that length of time is important for kids in terms of consequences and being held accountable. And we know that the juvenile system, given the way it's written and the statutory time limits that are in there, is just a much faster system than the adult system. So the cases don't linger in the juvenile system like they might in the adult system.
Now, part of the original thinking in turning 17-year-olds over to the adult court is deterrence, I'm sure. So if these same 17-year-olds, who are thinking about maybe contemplating a crime, are they more likely to do it if the 17-year-old now goes to juvenile court instead of adult court?
Well, I think again, the research, are there individual cases where that might happen? Sure. But in a sort of a general sense, the we're really talking about kids who are, again, kids who are impulsive, who are out with their peers. Most of these kids commit offenses when they're out with their friends. Somebody says, let's go do this. They kind of go along with the crowd. They're not, it's sort of by their very nature not stopping to think through the consequences of what they're doing oftentimes. And so, to sort of allude that they sit down and sort of a characteristic of them is they're not weighing the consequences one way or the other. So, sitting down individually with them when it's nice and calm, they might say that, but when they're out with their friends who kind of says, the friend says, well, let's go knock over these mailboxes, they kind of go, okay. So it's not, they don't tend to take that kind of thoughtful approach to their behavior that we hope that we know adults do.
How does Wisconsin compare to other states in terms of legislation like this?
Wisconsin now is one of 10 states left that treat kids under 18 automatically as adults. There are, in recent years, Connecticut, Massachusetts have both changed. New York is changing, and Illinois has changed. So Wisconsin is a sort of a dwindling number of states that treat some youth under 18 automatically as adults. So hopefully we'll be one of nine, ultimately maybe one of eight, or that will, we'll make our changes. But the trend around the country has, the minority of states have done this, and that minority is becoming even smaller, and Wisconsin is hopefully on the right trend.
So as we've seen, this bill has bipartisan support. What's next?
Well, we've had a vote in an assembly committee that was unanimous and a vote in the Senate committee that was unanimous, and so we're working to get it, the political steps to get it, to the floor and hopefully get it passed through both the Senate and Assembly yet here this spring. And it would take effect in January of 2015, so it provides time for counties and law enforcement and people to kind of get things geared up.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Jim Moser is a deputy director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, Ohio has the world's largest basket. Minnesota has the world's largest ball of twine, evidently. And what does Wisconsin have?
Something even better, the world's largest six-pack. And nobody knows more about it than the master brewer who keeps it full. Randy Hughes is brewmaster at City Brewery in La Crosse. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the obvious question. How big is the world's largest six-pack?
Well, they're quite big. Each individual tank or can holds 3,700 barrels of beer. So just to put that in terms that most people can understand a little easier, you're talking about 1.2 million cans worth of beer per tank.
Whoa.
That's a lot of beer.
That's a lot of beer.
So how is its number one status verified?
Well, that's a bit fuzzy. these tanks will be celebrating their 45th birthday. They were built in 1969. And there were not actually even worldwide a lot of really large tanks back then. And I'm not sure that it was actually verified, but hey, go out on the internet and Google on world's largest six-pack, and this is what you get. So if it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
And nobody's out there challenging this claim, saying we've got a bigger six-pack.
Well, to my knowledge, nobody has. And which is a little strange. There are much bigger tanks out there. I'm just not sure that they're in six-pack form and outside and have, are made up like cans. So, in fact, we have larger tanks than that. It's just that some of them are inside and they don't have the logos all over them.
Well, what kind of beer are you storing in there?
Well, for most of its life, they held old-style lager. That was the primary number one beer that the G. Heilman Brewing Company produced for about 100 years. Now it can be a variety of different things, depending on what we need them for. Again, with the large capacity, it has to be enough volume to be able to fill the tank up. So it's got to be 3,000 barrels or more per brand. But at any given time, it can be anywhere from you know, one brand to six brands. But we turn them over about every month.
Do you know, back in 1969, was the plan, we're going to make storage tanks that look like a six-pack? Or did somebody make a design for storage tanks and somebody said, hey, it looks like a six-pack, we better paint those?
You know, that I actually can't tell you. They were the first very large tanks for the G. Heilman Brewing Company. They were, they would have been about five times larger than their largest tanks at the time. And they were also the first tanks west of, or east of 3rd Street that runs north-south down through La Crosse. So it was a big deal at the time, but I don't know if it was designed with that purpose in mind or not, or if somebody just looked at it and said, hey, that's a six-pack. So I really can't answer that.
Rob and I were talking about them before the show started, and I asked him if they had pop tops, which, of course, we're going to ask you. And he said you couldn't drink it anyway unless you were a really big giant. So I'm guessing there's no pop tops on these, right?
Well, there's no pop tops, but they do have, you know, vents on the top, and we have what we call safeties on top of them. And there has been an occasion when they've been overfilled and had beer streaming out of the top and down the sides. But that's, fortunately enough, that's pretty rare, but no pop tops.
I'm sure I'm not the first person in the world to make a Homer Simpson joke, giant beer. But suppose some ambitious person wanted to drink all the beer in there at a reasonable pace. How long do you reckon it would take to polish that off?
A reasonable pace? What is
well,
that?
With not like constantly drinking breaks for, you know, food. That's
well,
sort of thing.
You know, and that's a good question. And actually, we've got a sign that's been out front, you know, as long as the tanks have been here, with facts on that, as far as how many cans and six packs and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I actually had to go out there and verify all those numbers to make sure they were true. But basically, it would provide a person with a six pack of beer a day for 3,351 years.
Whoa.
So you're set.
So, yeah. But I do know the tour guides in the old days used to tell the tours that during Oktoberfest here in La Crosse that they used to drain the six-pack. And I always used to laugh because even in its best year, and we get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people here in La Crosse for Oktoberfest, best year ever. They probably did no more than one half of one of the cans. So,
wow,
that's a lot of beer.
It's funny. I always think of Milwaukee as the big brewery city. Is La Crosse a pretty big beer city too?
Well, originally we were the G. Heilman Brewing Company, and we did about 5 million barrels of beer a year. So, for this side of the state, we're definitely the largest existing brewery. Milwaukee, of course, used to be the beer capital of the Midwest, and still is in some respects, but La Crosse is no slouch, that's for sure.
Do you know how far back La Crosse's brewing history goes?
Well, this brewery, which of course is now the City Brewery, goes back to 1853. Originally, when Gottlieb Heilman started brewing, the brewery itself was constructed in 1858, so about as long as La Crosse has been here in some fashion or another. So, and it's been almost continuous operation ever since. Obviously, there was Prohibition in there, and a couple of rough year or several months between the Heilman and City Brewery transition. But today, we've got 500 people working here and making all kinds of beer and different products. So
is this a major tourist attraction? Do people come from all over to see this thing?
It's amazing. Even, in the old days, back when we ran tours and all that, we had tens of thousands of people over the course of a year on the tours. But even now, at least every week, I see people out there stopping, getting their picture taken by the world's largest six-pack, and then hopping in the car and driving away. And they're probably the most photographed beer tanks in the world, I'm guessing.
Wait, are they outside? Where are they housed?
They are outside.
They're outside?
you know, they're obviously vertical, and they, they're insulated, you know, for the cold Wisconsin weathers. And, boy, they've, over the years, they've probably gone, we've probably run several million barrels of beer through those tanks.
All right, Randy, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in.
Thank you.
That's Randy Hughes. He's the brewmaster at City Brewing Company in La Crosse, where you'll find the subject of this week's Curious Wisconsin segment, the world's biggest six-pack.
And by the way, if you have got a question about Wisconsin, something that's kind of cool that you might like a little more information about, please call the Central Time hotline. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. We'd love to know what's on your mind and help you get a little more information for it and share it with everybody else.
You can also post your questions on the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it is our Food Friday, and this week we'll talk to one of WPR's in-house foodies who has been going kind of nuts, actually, cooking lots of Meyer lemon recipes. Today we sampled some Meyer lemon ceviche, and we'll hear about that.
Right, there was ice cream. She made margaritas but didn't bring those to work, and there was something else.
Lemon bars.
Lemon bars, right, of course, the obvious one. So looking forward to that. We'll also talk to a New York Times reporter about her article comparing Duluth and Superior, neighboring cities that have taken different paths as their state governments have gone in opposite directions. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.